Bhadi Sanghe Sindhu Mide Uwagi Roku Nam Dakshina Chabasho Guru Radamadala Gamna Yatayami Chadan Sakye Chonam La Chanchu Padu Dagni Kyapsuchi Dagi Chashengi Besanamgi Dola Penche Sangye Dubasho Chadan Sakye Chonam La Chanchu Padu Dagni Kyapsuchi Dagi Chashengi Besanamgi Dola Penche Sangye Dubasho Chodan Sogye Chonam La Chanchu Padu Dani Kyapsu Chi Dagi Choshe Gibe Sanam Ki Dora Benche Sange Duba Sho
A couple things. First, the most important, I'd like to welcome my mother. She's right there. And you have to thank her for everything, okay? yeah. And truly grew up in an enlightened environment and, you know, very lucky. So that's her. Then tonight is just a free-for-all. And you don't have to be relevant or anything, and just ask any question you feel like, and that's all. We'll do it for about an hour and a half, something. And I don't care what it's about, and you're welcome to ask anything you like, okay? So it doesn't even have to be about this course or anything. All right, so any Dharma question you have. Can you hear me okay? Okay, so just go ahead. Anybody? Nope. Okay, we'll stop. yeah, go ahead.
When you talk about 1 hour of meditation, does that include your sadness?
yeah.
I mean, if they're memorized, how about that?
Yeah. Anila asked me if I say that you need an hour of meditation a day, and I mean specifically for seeing emptiness directly, okay? For reaching Samden Dhamma Nyodo Micho Me, which is the meditation level you need to reach to see emptiness. And actually, Chijan Rinpoche mentions it in this chart. He mentions that level. If you look at it, it's somewhere in there. I don't mean sadhanas. I don't mean preliminaries. I don't mean tonglen. Okay? I'm talking 1 hour a day of jogom. We're going to go over that tomorrow, but jogom means fixed meditation on an object. So, meaning going into a deep state of meditation. A good sadhana, and I say good, okay? A good sadhana practice is a shagom, where it's a movie. You're playing a movie in front of your mind, and you're seeing many, many different scenes go by, and many different emotions, and many different beings coming and going, and disappearing, and shrinking, and withdrawing, and going out. And, you know, that's a shagom. And technically speaking, you can develop shamatha about a shagom, but it's very difficult. And I'm talking jogom on a single object where your breath is very, very deep and your mind is very, very deep and fixed on a single object. So, you know, a lot of people are trying to cover their other practices during Michael Roach's hour. No. Okay. you know. So it's kind of deceptive, you know. You need like 15, 20 minutes for the preliminaries. Maybe 15, 10 to 15. And then you need an hour of straight jogom. And if you have to do sadhanas or something like that, that's shagom. And maybe you do it in the evening or something. I find that it takes less, personally, less concentration to do a shagom than a jogom. You know, less concentration to do a review meditation and a sadhana meditation than it does to do a deep, focused meditation on a single object. But that's that's what I'd say about that. Okay, I'm talking deep meditation, okay, on a single object. Yes.
So would that object that you choose be different from an object that you would have in a sadhana?
I'll repeat the question, okay? The people doing the taping said I have to repeat the question. So, yeah, she said, does that mean that it would have to be a different object than one of the objects in the sadhana? No, you could use one of the parts of the sadhana, you know, and personally that's what I would do. I would go, like if you're doing an 11-step sadhana, go through 4 or 5, reach the part of the sadhana that you'd like to do shamatha on. Like you could stop at the refuge part and do shamatha on the refuge visualization and like that. So yeah, you could incorporate it that way. And that's very typical. If you're doing Vajrayogini, you could stop at Ngangde Yinde and do that mental recitation there and focus on the meditation at that point, especially the Shachin Dzogrim. And if you don't know what all these are, then you're not supposed to know, okay? But yeah, you could do that. Very, very proper. Probably more efficient. Go through the Shargom, go through the sadhana, stop on one of the practices. There's normally like 10 or 11 kiriams there. And then you stop on one of them and practice that. Practice the same object for like 1.5 to 2 months. Okay, stop in the same place for 1.5 to 2 months. And then it's not bad if you go quickly through the rest. And it's not bad if you do your minimum commitments for all the other sadhanas you're supposed to be doing. You know, focus on one. And don't break your commitments, you know, do your minimum commitments for the other commitments you have, but focus on one sadhana and focus on one scene in one sadhana for 1.5 to 2 months. And then you must vary it after that. You dry out after a month or two. You know, it gets as clear as it's going to get. And then move on to something else to keep some variety in your meditation. I personally find it that way. Okay? Yeah.
Yeah. What's the best object for shamatha?
He said, what's the best object for shamatha? I mean, the classic answer is an image of a Buddha. And I think, you know, there's the Coke Classic, and then there's all these other kinds of Coke, like Cherry Coke and Diet Coke. And I mean, what they call Choki Tuku. You know, all these images like Tara, everything else is a Tuku, meaning an emanation of Lord Buddha. You know what I mean? An emanation of the Buddha. And then Choki Tuku, which means, you know, classic emanation. Emanation classic is with the long ears and the bump on his head and golden body and all that. I mean, I think a lot of Americans actually find that image difficult to relate to, you know, and they feel more comfortable visualizing Tara or Manjushri. I mean, the reason that Tara and Manjushri emanate as these beautiful, sexy deities is that the only reason is that you find it more attractive. That's their shtick. That's what they do. They're supposed to emanate in a way that you would find attractive. So it's not at all improper or a mistake to pick the one that appeals to you the most, even just physically, and concentrate on that one. I think, you know, the classic answer is visualize Lord Buddha, and I think a lot of people find it a lot easier to relate to Tara or to Manjushri or something that, you know, and then people say, which sadhana am I supposed to do? You know, I can't do that sadhana well because I have 5 other sadhanas to do. But the point is to pick one called, that's what yidam means. Yidam means pick the one that you feel the closest connection to. The closest automatic comfortable connection to, and concentrate on that. Because remember that, you know, whichever, sadhana means to reach that deity. So the word sadhana means to reach that deity. So if you reach one, you reach all of them. You see what I mean? It's not like you're going to have to go back and start over again with Yamantaka because you've reached Vajrayogini already or something like that. When you reach one, you've reached all of them. They're all just different forms of the same guy or girl. Okay, so you got to remember that, you know, when you're like torn, I have 15 sadhanas to do. I'll do 3 minutes on each one. You won't achieve anything. You won't be able to do it. Focus on one that you feel most attracted to. Concentrate on reaching them, which is the meaning of sadhana. And then when you reach them, you'll meet all the other ones. They'll be there also. You know, when you reach them, they'll be there. Reach has two meanings in the word sadhana. One, it means to come into contact with that being. And later, it means to become that being. You see what I mean? So you reach them in both senses. And you can't do it if you're like trying to do 15 at once. You see? Reach one, and you will reach the others automatically. You don't have to worry about it. So do your minimum commitments for 5 sadhanas, you know, which is typically like, I don't know, a certain number of mantras, short mantras. They're called Nyewe Nyimbo, means a short mantra. And then focus on the one that attracts you the most. And don't be embarrassed and don't feel like it's wrong to focus on the one that you find most attractive, because that's why they emanate that way. They're supposed to hook you. And that's their shtick. That's what they do. That's why they appear in different forms. Otherwise, they would all look like Koch Classic Buddha, you know. And they don't. Okay? And don't be shy about it, you know. Don't have this, what do you call it? I don't know. It's some Judeo-Christian thing or Western civilization thing that it's somehow wrong to be attracted to your God, you know. In Buddhism, it's cool, you know. You will be like them. You should want to be like them. You should be attracted to them, even physically. You know, that they look beautiful to you and you'd like to be like that. And their physical beauty reflects the purity of their mind. And you can work at it, you know, in the sense that I would like to become like them physically, which would mean I have reached their mental state also. You see what I mean? Through reaching their mental state. And that's fine. So concentrate on the one that attracts you the most. That's why they go to all that trouble to emanate all those different bodies, you know. It means each one has a different, fits a different personality. You have to find the one that fits your personality. Okay? Like that. Yeah?
I have a question about tulkas.
Yeah?
I don't think there were any before the 15th session, were there? Did they kind of come along to help gain support for the monasteries after the popular lamas died and were bringing in all the goodies?
She said, I thought tulku was a thing, like a system that developed in Tibet. After a great lama died, and then just because of the wishes of everyone, and perhaps even because of like worldly considerations, that the system of tulku came about. Tulku, we've studied it, right? I think we were in Arizona, we did it. Means emanation of an enlightened being, and 1 millisecond after you reach enlightenment, you know, there's 4 bodies of a Buddha. In the first millisecond of enlightenment, you only have 3 of them. Because one of them acts as a cause for your tulku. Tulku means the ability to appear on millions of planets as millions of different people at the same moment. And it's not, according to Buddhism, it's not impossible that every person you've ever met in your life was the emanation of one being. And that it's all a big Truman Show. And they're all trying to help you. You know, it's a big plot to get you enlightened, you know. Or that some percentage of the people around you are already enlightened. Those would be tukus. So the word tuku literally means a physical manifestation of an omniscient being which appears spontaneously. They don't have any premeditation. They don't think, I have to send out this tuku, this tuku, this tuku. They appear whenever a being is ready. And that's a quality of a Buddha. When you get to be a Buddha, one of the reasons to try to be a Buddha is that you will gain that ability to appear all over the United States, in every little town, sitting on a bus next to somebody who needs you at that moment. And that's a quality, that's one of the goals of your life, has to be that you want to become like that. Then in Tibet, the word tuku came to mean... reincarnated lamas were called tukus, on the theory that they were emanations of one being, right? So, you know, there's no problem for there to be 2 karmapas at one time. The little Buddha movie was right. You know what I mean? No problem at all for there to be multiple bodies, and it's happened a lot in the history of Tibet. So technically speaking, they are emanations of an omniscient being who maybe got enlightened 1 million years ago. Okay, Now, I was walking around Tujan Rinpoche's stupa at the winter debates in Gundan, and he came barreling around the corner of the stupa on his bike and ran me over. And it hurt a lot, you know. And I was like getting up and dusting myself off and saying, I'm sick of these little spoiled tukus around the monastery, you know. Everyone treats them like they're gods, you know. And they find out at about age 10 that they can terrorize everybody. And everybody will say, oh, thank you, Rinpoche, you know. And, you know, and I was like really getting fed up with this thing, you know. And you hear the older geshis grumbling, you know. I had to wait 3 years for my geshi exam because 6 tukus got pushed ahead of me because they were tukus. And they've never read a page of scripture or something. You know, I mean, there's a thing in the monastery, there's this feeling, you know, and so I was going through one of these mental affliction attacks about this little tuku, and then I dust myself off, and he goes into his room. He lives on top of the temple, you know, he lives on the second floor. I've never been in his personal quarters. Then I get this message, Rinpoche wants to see you right now, you know, and I'm like, okay. And they take me upstairs, and, you know, I go through all the motions, I bow to him, and I'm still remembering the bicycle, and he's like 9 or 10 at that time. And then he says, Mako, you know, I gotta tell you something. You really have some problem with anger and getting mad when people hurt you, and you need to study some Lam Rim, you know, and I have this Lam Rim for you, and I want you to read it over a few times and, you know, work on that, you know. you never know. You really never know. So I've come to a point. Don't think of tukus that way. Really, they're always. I think it's one of the most holy things about Tibetan Buddhism, and later in your tantric practice, you'll appreciate it. That even in the monasteries, in the sutra monasteries, in the non-tantric monasteries, that you decide that this person is enlightened. And you have to deal with it. You know what I mean? You have to relate to them. And oftentimes they will seem to be very impolite or very lazy or very goofball. And then suddenly you see them for what they are. I mean, it might take years. And then suddenly one day you see them for what they are. So never think like that about tukus. They're amazing, you know. And I don't mean to say they won't seem like little spoiled brats sometimes. But then one day they'll show you who they are, and on that day you're like, oh, oops, you know. you know, and I've seen it happen many times, so don't doubt it. Don't doubt it.
Steve Seagal, at the age of 40,
She said, what about Steven Seagal, who they decided at age 40 he's a tuku? I mean, if you need another tuku story, I'll tell you, okay? I get this phone call from this lady in New York. She says, I have the Dalai Lama of Mongolia here sitting next to me. And I'm like, yeah, right. And then she says, he wants to talk to you. I think you should talk to him. And I'm like, I'm busy, you know. And she's like, oh, no, you should talk to him. And I said, okay, I'll talk to him. And so I get on the phone and I'm talking to him and I say, what's your name? And he says, Jetsun Dampa, you know. And I say, well, I never heard of that, you know. And then he says, I said, so you're the head lama of Mongolia? He says, yeah, I am. And then I said, what's your monastery? And he says, I don't have a monastery, you know. And then I said, well, what do you mean? You know, are you a monk? And he says, no, I'm not a monk. And I'm like, but you're the head lama of Mongolia? He says, yeah, I am. And then I said, well, I'm just being polite at this point, you know, like, are you from Ulaanbaatar or where are you from? He says, I've never been to Mongolia. And, and I'm like, oh, you're the head of Mongolian Buddhism, you're not a monk, and you've never been to Mongolia. And he says, right. And then I said, where do you live? And he says, I live down near Belakopi, you know. And I say, oh, I'm from Saramay. He says, oh, yeah, two of my sons are in Saramay. I said, you have sons, you know? He says, yeah, they turned out to be classmates of mine, you know. Now I'm placing him, you know. He's this old man in this village who's been there his whole life, and then somehow he sold this lady, this poor, unsuspecting American lady, is believing that he's the head of Mongolian Buddhism, you know. And I'm like, I'm very turned off. I'm very, like, disgusted. And I say, well, you know, I hope you have a good trip, and I'd like to meet you. I'm too busy, and good luck to you, and talk to you later, you know. And then I went home and told my lama about this imposter, you know. And he says, you made a big mistake. And I said, what do you mean? He says, he is the head of Mongolian Buddhism, you know. And then there's this long story. He can't go back. There's a political problems, you know. And when I went to Mongolia, from the airport, when we drove to Ganden Monastery, the other Ganden, the Mongolian Ganden, there's this huge palace by the side of the road. And I'm like, wow. Who lives there? And they say, that's Jetsun Dampa's palace. You know? And he's stuck in India, and we're trying to get him here, you know. And I'm like, so I think you have to be really, you never know. You know, who knows who Steven Seagal is? You know, you never know. Better not to judge anything, you know. Just leave it alone. You never know. God knows, you know. It'd be very, very, typical for an enlightened being to emanate as a nice, handsome movie star in America. Instead of being abnormal or strange or inappropriate, it would be very typical for them to do something like that. It would be very typical Buddha behavior to act like that. Do I know he's a tuku? I have no idea, you know. But I say be careful with it, and suspend judgment until you're sure either way. And don't go, you know, throwing yourself down on his feet and saying, because Joe Schmo said you're a tuku, you're a tuku. You know what I mean? Wait and see his qualities. And if he's a great teacher and he's explaining Dharma well, and then that's, you know, then throw yourself down on their feet, you know. And suspend your judgment either way. You know, also if you go around saying he is a tuku, then you're also making a judgment which I think is inappropriate. I think you have to judge the person for his teaching or her teaching, you know. And it's the same with Jetsun Ma in Maryland, who's a hairdresser from Brooklyn with two kids, and she's the holder of the Nyingma lineage of blah blah blah. And I was like, yeah, right, you know. And then when I met her and I taught at her center, I was extremely impressed and extremely gained a lot of faith in her. And I think you have to be really careful with that stuff. That's all I'm saying. Just be careful with it. And don't judge either way. I'd also don't trust people who say, oh, such and such a lama is an enlightened being. I say, how do you know? And they say, I like him, you know. And I say, you know, is that all? You know, is there any other, you know, the main quality of an enlightened being, of all the qualities they have, is to speak the Dharma. And that's their most important quality, and that's their most important activity. So if they're teaching the Dharma properly and well and accurately, then I feel comfortable to have faith in them. And, you know, and until I see them teach, until I know them well, I would suspend judgment. You know, be careful. You can really collect a lot of bad karma that way. Okay? Yeah?
Can you explain pramana from a crossing ego viewpoint?
He said, can you explain pramana from a prasangika viewpoint? Pramana means tsema, and tsema means valid perception. Okay, so a couple things to say about tsema. Valid perception, the definition in the lower schools is sadumilue rikpa, which means a fresh, unmistaken perception. When you get into the higher school, prasangika, they say it's just milui rikpa, which means an unmistaken perception. And they cut out the sadhu part. The reason they cut out the fresh, in the lower schools, a memory is not a valid perception. Like, just because you remember something doesn't mean it's correct. They don't count a memory, something that you remember, as valid as your direct physical perceptions or your direct logical perceptions. So all the schools agree that a valid perception can either be with your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, or body, or it can be with your logic. You know, that when you come to a conclusion logically, that's as good as seeing it with your eyes. And those are all tsema or pramana. But there's a difference in the schools about whether memory is a valid perception or not. So that's the first thing to say about it. Second thing to say about it is that there's a reason why we say valid and not correct. And I'll give you an example. Like, I used to be a VP in this big corporation, and I would make decisions about millions of dollars of diamonds. And I remember one time I made this huge wrong decision, you know, which he never let me forget, my boss. And it was, I was in India, I was busy, I was on the phone, I told somebody to buy 24,000 carats of diamonds. And it was supposed to be 14,000 carats of diamonds. And you're talking 100,000 stones. And he went ahead and bought them, and then suddenly my boss didn't have any money left. And he's like, that was a big mistake, you know. And I said, no, it wasn't a mistake. He said, why not? I said, I did a calculation. Actually, I did a calculation, and it was that we needed, at that day, we needed 24,000 carats of diamonds to meet the needs of Christmas rush, you know. And I calculated it, and the calculations were valid. They were justified at that moment, okay? It happened that they weren't correct, okay? So there's a distinction between justified and correct, okay? And that's why we say valid perception rather than correct perception. Atsema, or a pramana, means given the information at your disposal, you see something a certain way. So we can say your mind or your perceptions made a valid decision about what this object was, given the information that your mind had available to it. Okay? But they're wrong. Okay? The first time you have a truly correct perception is when you see emptiness directly. And shortly after that experience, you become aware that every single perception you have ever had in your life was mistaken. And that every moment of your life, as you experience the world around you, you were misunderstanding it. And you were misinterpreting it. And it was not the way you thought it was. So all throughout your life, you've had some kind of validity to your perceptions, because that's the best you could do with your wimpy mind. Okay? But if you had really understood the nature of the thing, you would realize that that was wrong. So that's the story on pramana. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, she said, explain the truku thing with regard to emptiness, okay? And that's true. That what is a truku base level from his side or her side? What is a truku? A truku is four limbs and a torso. Okay? Really. That's all the information your eye is giving you to your brain, you know? So if this person turns out to be an emanation of an enlightened being, a truku, ultimately, it's only because you have the virtue to see them that way. Okay? Ultimately, that's the only thing that makes them a truku in your eyes, in your experience, is that you are so virtuous that you have the good karma to meet an enlightened being in your life. And then another person might come up to them and to see the same four limbs and torso as being a schmuck. Okay? And so who's right? What is he really? It's the question on Friday night in Seichen Ling at the Unitarian Church. That pen, you know, was this cylinder from its own side a pen or a dog treat? From its own side, which one is it? Yeah, you have to say neither. Okay, it depends on how many legs you have, you know what I mean? If you're a four-legged critter and you walk in here and I say, hey, you know, look, you'll probably more tend to chew on it than write with it, okay? You perceive it as a dog, as something to chew on. And if you're a human and you come in here, you perceive it more as a pen. But you can't say that one being is more right than another. If you think about it, that cylinder is a coexisting in two realms at the same moment. It exists in a dog's realm, and it exists in a separate world called the human realm. And they're both experiencing this cylinder in a different way. So it's very interesting to reflect on the fact that there are two realms which are totally different, can coexist in the same 50 square feet at the same time. Two totally different worlds are existing there. There's the world as the dog sees it, and there's the world as the human sees it. And neither one is more correct than the other, you see? They both have equal right to be there, because some being is there who's experiencing that way. Okay? So, is Atruku the same as this pen? Is Atruku the same as this room or this place? Of course, you know, quite validly, they can appear to a person who doesn't have enough virtue as not being Atruku, as being, you know, some big hunky movie star who's kind of dumb, you know. And then they can appear to... they can validly appear to a person with great faith and great virtue as being an enlightened being and help them that way. And they can appear to themselves as one or the other, depending on their own virtue. Who's right? You see, it's neither one of the above, the same as the pen. That's the emptiness of tukus, okay? There, so suppose you reach the state in your own personal life where your heart was so pure that you saw everybody around you as a tukku. You know, I mean, consider the possibilities, you know. That is actually the goal of Buddhism. So are you kidding yourself? Are they really tukkus or not? Is it really a pen or really a dog treat, you know? Yeah, it's neither. So it's quite possible that you could be in a third realm, you see? There could be a third realm going on here. Of people who are very, very virtuous, who have kept their book well, and are perceiving this whole event as some totally different reality, you know. And that is the emptiness of Steven Seagal, okay? And it's not a joke. And that's the whole way to go to heaven. Is it related? Okay. Yeah, no. By the way, no contradiction, nothing strange, nothing improper to say that Steven Seagal may be perceiving himself as a schmuck, as a plain old normal person. And he's quite aware that all this is bunk, and he's not an enlightened being. And you see, it doesn't matter. If I have sufficient virtue to see him as a tukku, he will function to me as a tukku. And he will guide me to an enlightened state. You see, no contradiction there at all. It's not at all impossible that you're in a room full of people because of your keeping your book well, you're perceiving them as angels, and they are validly, but not, well, they are validly perceiving themselves as normal people, and there's no contradiction there. And they can say to you, good evening. And you hear it as some Buddha giving you a private instruction. That's the meaning of the word Kadampa. Okay? The meaning of the word Kadampa is a person who's reached a level where every ga, everything a person says to them, Dampa, looks like the Buddha's talking to them. They say, you know, Kieran's always doing that. Winston's kid, you know? Like, he's just a kid, right? And I walk up to him, I say, Kieran, how are you doing? And he looks at me. The first thing is like, are you keeping your vows well, you know? You know? And then he goes like that. He's always doing this, you know. Like, if you did, you know. And whether I see him that way, or whether I see him as just a kid who's waving his arms, and how he sees himself are three totally different things. And there's no contradiction that two realities can exist in the same person at one time any more than this has to be a pen or this has to be a dog treat. That's the emptiness of all objects. That's the only reason we can get enlightened in this life. That's why Tantra can work. Tantra's effectiveness depends on the emptiness of this cylinder and on the emptiness of four limbs and a torso that we call Steven Seagal. Okay? Yeah. Sure?
Okay.
She said, how do you know that you're hearing what this person from their side is actually saying? Don't forget the thing where the Buddha was sitting under the Buddha tree, the Bodhi tree, and the last shot of the demons in this life, you know, they take these spears and they like throw it at him. And then all he perceives is the shower. They turn to flowers in midair in his perception, right? There's a big teaching on emptiness there. That was really true. They perceive them as weapons, and they are really intending to do harm. They want him to bleed, you know. They're throwing these things. And then he looks at them and he sees these people throwing flowers on him. Congratulations, you know, great job. And there's a lesson on emptiness there. Okay, what you don't know what they perceive themselves as saying. You see what I mean? How they perceive their words is one thing that you will know the day you become enlightened. Okay, you can read how they're perceiving their words. But if you hear those words as unpleasant, you can be sure there's only one person you can blame. And that's you. You know, if you see the swords as swords, that's your problem. You don't know how they're perceiving, and it doesn't really matter. And don't think that it's not real, because you're not hearing what they intended, okay? Because nothing's like that. No object in the world has its own self-existence. No object in the world exists from its own sign. Don't think something weird is going on because you hear something amazing and they're just telling you something normal. That's the way emptiness works. That's the way your whole life has always been. And there's no contradiction there. The whole world can be calling you a schmuck and you're hearing them singing your praises because of your karma. That's reality. It's never been anything else. Don't think it's like weird or something like that, or it's somehow unreal because of that. That makes it real. That's all it's ever been. Okay? And there's only one person you can blame if thing goes wrong. And there's only one person you can pat on the back if things go right. And that's you. Okay. What's the difference between that and a delusion, okay? In highest Prasangika, right, they discuss the idea of, how to see it. There's a discussion of the idea of mistaken perception, you see what I mean? And that gets back to your thing about pramana, you know. How do you, you know, suppose you're in a mental hospital and you think everybody is God around you, you know. What's the difference between that and a person who's been practicing Tantra so well that they really do see everybody as a deity? In Prasangika, they don't draw a distinction between those two states. They are both equally valid. You see what I mean? It's very interesting. The other schools try to draw a distinction between a state of mind, a tsema which is correct and a tsema which is incorrect or something like that. And Prasangika says, no, there's no such distinction. The problem with the guy in the mental hospital is that the causes for him to see that or her to see that are not stable. They weren't created by virtue practice. They weren't created by proper tantric instruction and proper tantric training and proper understanding of emptiness, and it will wear out. You know, it's not occurring through their wisdom and their understanding of the emptiness of the people around them. And sooner or later, it always turns into a nightmare. You know, they go up and down, in and out of this state. The fact that they have that delusion for a short time is because of some virtue they did in the past. But they don't understand it. They don't understand the emptiness of what's going around them. And then they can't maintain that perception. You see what I mean? Tantric heaven means you have prajnaparamita. You have the perfection of wisdom. You know that it's all your perceptions, and you're playing on that to keep it going. And that's enlightenment. You know? Yeah?
But even when you perceive emptiness directly, it's unstable. You can fall back. And so you're much higher along on the path. So that's something that would be extinguishing. So it seems that the distinction is not valid. The distinction is the same. You perceive it that way. You believe you've seen the emptiness, but you're not stable.
Yeah, when you reach the direct perception of emptiness, tonglam, path of seeing, has two parts. The first part is called Parche Melam, the direct perception of emptiness. And then the second part is called Jetop Yeshi, which is the next 24 hours. And you see, I have all these understandings that are not the direct perception of emptiness. When you come out of your first direct experience of emptiness, you go back to seeing all the objects around you as self-existent. And you cannot stop yourself. But you know you're wrong. So before that, you were seeing everything as self-existent, and you didn't know you were wrong. After that, you still see everything as self-existent, and you do know you're wrong. And so one of the three mental afflictions, which is only three out of 84,000 mental afflictions, are forever eliminated at the path of seeing. One of them is the intellectual belief that what you're seeing is correct. You see? So forevermore, you will never believe what you're seeing. And that's what illusion means in Buddhism. That whole period, from that moment you come out of the direct perception of emptiness until the day you become enlightened or become an arhat, that whole period is called gyumatabu, meaning illusory. Illusory in the sense that things still look self-existent and you realize that's your problem. You know, you realize that you're wrong when you see them that way. Okay? And even after the eighth bodhisattva bhumi, at the eighth bodhisattva bhumi, you eliminate the perception of things as self-existent. What are you supposed to do on 9 and 10? You know, what's left to do? Okay? One of the things is a purification of the potentiality for seeing things as self-existent. Meaning, during bodhisattva levels 9 and 10, things stop appearing to you as self-existent. Okay? At bodhisattva level number 8, you stop seeing them as self-existent. Permanently. And that's actually Mahayana Nirvana, is when you reach bodhisattva level number 8. And then you still have to go through 9 and 10 to get to enlightenment. Okay? So yeah, there's a stability problem when you, right after you come out of the path of seeing, yeah, you're very weak in your direct perception of emptiness. And you have to keep reminding yourself and going back to it. And it's the reminding process that lets you reach Nirvana. And still, all of that is projection. You know, the fact that you have to live in a mind which is still not stable is due to your past karma. And that's also a projection. Okay? And that's a little touchy, okay? There's a place in the Diamond Cutter where Subhuti says, you know what? I'm a Drachomba. I'm an arhat. I've reached Nirvana. But if I thought I was an arhat, I wouldn't be an arhat, would I? You see what I mean? And what he's meaning is, when he has this pleasant experience of his own mind as being totally free of any mental afflictions. He has this very, very wonderful state he's reached where he cannot have jealousy anymore. Incapable of getting irritated at anyone. Incapable of feeling anxiety. You know, incapable of being upset. Incapable of feeling jealousy. This is what an arhat is. That's also a projection. His mind is empty as Steven Seagal, as empty as this pen. And his good karma is forcing him to think that it's clean, and therefore it is clean. And that's very touchy. The difference is, he knows what's going on. He knows that he's making it happen with his past karma. And so he knows how to keep it going. And that's why after you get to Buddha Paradise, you don't have to go out anymore. You cannot come out of a Buddha Paradise because you know how to keep it there. You just keep doing good deeds and you keep seeing it that way. And you know you're only seeing it and you're quite happy to be there. Because that's all anything else ever was. Yeah? Okay. You in the back. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. No, the lady behind you. Yeah. Go ahead.
I have a
kind of
question about karma.
Yeah.
You, at one point, had said that some things that happened to you
I understand, yeah. She said that once I was describing how death in my family had gotten me to be into Buddhism. So the death itself seems to be an unpleasant thing, but the fact that it pushed me to become a monk, for example, is a good thing. You see what I mean? So I think what you're saying is that a good karma or a bad karma? You know what I mean? Gampopa was married before he met Milarepa, and then one of the great lamas of the Kagyu lineage. And then his wife died. And his wife's uncle came to console him. And they're sitting around the table having tea, you know, and Gampopa says, "It's so wonderful my wife died, you know. Now I can go practice all the time, you know." And the uncle got angry and threw dirt in his face and said, "You heartless guy, you know, your wife had just died, you know." And I think the question is it a good karma or a bad karma? When you're in the business of deciding whether a karma is good or bad, the definition of good karma, it's very interesting. You see, what makes a sin in Buddhism? And what makes a good deed in Buddhism? You see what I mean? What's the difference between a chet and a mitzvah? You know? What's the difference? You see, is it a bad deed when God said it was a bad deed? Is it a bad deed because Buddha said it's a bad deed? How do you judge whether an action is karmically positive or negative? The definition of good karma in Buddhism is any action which, after a ripening process or a boomerang process, brings back to you a pleasant experience. Period. That's all. You know, that's the only basis of all Buddhist ethics. You know, does this action karmically come back to you as an experience of happiness or pain? And if it comes back to you as an experience of happiness, it's good karma. No matter what deed it is, you see? And if it comes back to you as pain, it's a bad karma. So if you take the case of a car accident, the feelings of pain and of separation and of loss that occur then are a result of bad karma. Why? Because they hurt. Okay, I mean, you see, that's the only thing that makes a bad deed in Buddhism. If it comes back to you as a feeling of pain, it must have been from a bad deed. Okay? And then going and going into a monastery, finding a way of life which saves your life and becomes the thing that you reach ultimate happiness by doing this thing, that's a good karma. So we would say that the pain that you felt after the car accident was a result of bad karma. The renunciation you felt, and it pushing you into a religious way of life that eventually brought you ultimate happiness, that's a result of a good karma, okay? And we call it a mixture of good and bad karma. Like that. Okay? Like that. Yeah. Yeah. Petra's question is this. You know, there's five levels of spiritual realization. Before you reach the first level, there's millions of years of they call pre-path realizations. Like you can have, and these are primarily the three trainings of ethical living, concentration, and wisdom. But you can have heavy experiences of those three trainings even before you reach the first path. Okay? There's a whole process before you reach the first path. The first path is reached when in this life you're truly tired of suffering. You're fed up with it. You have a direct decision that you don't want to live like that anymore. Okay? Live like what? Very simply, you can say it that you reach a point where you realize that every relationship you ever had is going to fail and collapse. Any possession you ever get is going to be torn away from you. Any family or friends, anything you get like that is going to be ripped away from you by circumstances. Your own body is a time bomb. It's going to kill you eventually. You know, it's just a question of when. And your own mind is in a state where even if you had the nicest girlfriend, the best car, the best lama, the best mind, the best everything, you would still go through this thing where after 6 months you'd be dissatisfied. People always ask me, "Geshe Michael, come stay in California. We'll take good care of you." I say, "No way." You know, when I visit twice a year, you appreciate me. If I stayed here, after 6 weeks, you'd start to think, maybe he doesn't teach that quite right. After 8 weeks, you'd be like, I wonder why he doesn't teach it that way. You know, after 3 months, you'd be like, I wish he would go back to New York, you know. And this is not a function of the Lama. This is a function of your own mind. You see what I mean? That's a benchmark of the samsaricness of your own mind, you know. And the Lama didn't change in those 6 months. You changed, you see. And the human mind is incapable of being happy. In its present condition, samsara is. Suffering is the fact that your own mind can't stay happy for more than a few days, about anything. And then you want something else. You know what I mean? So, by the way, you know when you're keeping your book well, when that process starts to change, you know, you'll see that you become less dissatisfied with the people and the places around you and your own mind. It, you know, relationships start to become more stable. Your interaction with other people becomes much more, it seems like it would be possible to have a relationship and not have it collapse in 2 weeks, you see what I mean, or 2 months, because your mind is changing, you see what I mean? So a nice benchmark of your success in your practice is this happening less to you? You know, is this dissatisfaction cycle happening with a longer term, you know? Okay, like not every 2 weeks, but every 4 weeks or something, you know what I mean? And then this is an indication that your mind is getting more pure, okay? So, what were we talking about before that? How do you know where you are? Yeah. That's the first path, okay? When you get tired of that cycle, you know, I don't know how many boyfriends or girlfriends you have to have before that happens, you know? I mean, it must be a certain number. But at a certain point, you realize that you can't be happy. You're not capable of it. And something always screws up. And then when you start figuring that out, that's renunciation, okay? Second path, understanding emptiness intellectually. Culminating in the understanding of how you are projecting everything. Third path, seeing emptiness directly. You knows you there when you're there, okay? No question. Never any question in your mind. I mean, yeah, as you said, reaching the third path, 20 minutes in the direct perception of emptiness, no question. You know, I mean, at that point, you really know where you are. And absolutely no doubt about it. People come to me and say, I think I saw emptiness. I said, what happened? They said, I was, you know, meditating and it felt like I was sliding off a boat and then there was this dark thing and then I felt like at one with the whole universe. Then I saw this green light with some gold and then I came out of it when my mom yelled at me. And they said, did I perceive emptiness? You know, I said, if you're not totally sure, then definitely you did not see it. You see what I mean? Every Arya who ever existed knows in the few minutes after the experience that they have seen emptiness directly and that they are an Arya. There's absolutely no question about it. So you know when you're there. Do you know as you move up through the Bodhisattva Bhumis that you're moving up through the Bodhisattva Bhumis? I think at that stage you would know. How are the Bodhisattva Bhumis defined? They are defined by the extraordinary practice of the six perfections linked with wisdom, linked with a perception of emptiness. So, you know, giving, ethical way of life, not getting angry at people, effort, joyful effort, and then those are the first six, and then the last four are those extra four perfections. Going up to the Bhumis is when you gain an extraordinary level of those six perfections, and then the four. So I think pre-path, before you reach the first path of getting fed up. I don't know if there's a lot of benchmarks there. Yeah, you might not know where you are at that point. But I think even when you get real renunciation, you may not be aware that it was happening. You see what I mean? You have deaths in your family. You have a major separation from your partner or something. You get a serious illness. Something like that. You reach a certain age and you realize that it's going to end soon. That's why all these old people come to temple in New Jersey, you know. I live in a Mongolian community. The only people who come to the services are over 60, you know. And so all those events would... I don't think you might... You might not know, you know, on a certain day, oh, I reached Soglam, you know. I reached the first path. But your behavior would start to change. You would be less interested in the world and you'd be much more interested in your study. And much more interested in meditation. So I think you'd have those external indications, but I don't think you'd know if 8 o'clock on this date I reached Soglam. But your behavior would start to change. You would start to be much more interested in practice and meditation and much less interested in family life or things like that. You know, your priorities would start to shift radically. And normally it takes a very tragic event of some kind or something like that. Normally it takes some wake-up call. I read this thing where people only change the part of their hair after someone dies in their family. You know, people comb their hair, especially men, always the same way. And then they figured out that once or twice in a lifetime, somebody will change their hair radically. And it's directly related to someone dying, or they get fired from a job they had for 10 years, or some tragic thing. And renunciation is the same, you know. So I don't think you would know, but your behavior would start to change radically. And it might happen a year after those events, or 2 years after that, or something like that. Okay? Yeah?
Could you please explain where bodhicitta fits into that? Is bodhicitta the gateway to the Mahayana, and you get the renunciation of bodhicitta, and then you're on the path?
She asked, where does bodhicitta come into the five-path system? Okay? When you reach the first path, which is getting fed up with life on your own side, okay, and I emphasize that it's probably in some kind of relationships with people. When you realize that your own mind cannot let you maintain a relationship with another person peacefully, that always your own mind is screwing things up, and your own mind is making it collapse, and your own mind is making you dissatisfied, and your own mind is making this thing seem bad after it seemed so good 6 weeks ago, you know. When you realize it's your own mind at work, and then you have the scriptures say that if you then extrapolate to other people and you say, you know, I used to walk up and down Fifth Avenue. My office was on Fifth Avenue. And it goes uphill to Central Park from the 40s. So you can look up the Fifth Avenue and see the bobbing heads of tens of thousands of people coming up and down Fifth Avenue. And this is Bergdorf Goodman, Saks Fifth Avenue, Harry Winston Diamonds, all these guys, you know. These are the cream of America. The people walking up and down the street have money, you know, and you see their heads bobbing up and down, and then it dawns on you at some point that every single one of them is deeply unhappy, you know, and there's this shock. You know, and the more of them you meet, the more convinced, you know, you don't have to meet a lot of them, and then you just realize none of them is any happier than anybody else. And it's this shock that you get into. And to realize that, specifically, that the actions they are undertaking to make them happy are making them very unhappy. And that's what's making them unhappy. It's very, it's like earth-shaking. Like you wake up one morning, you realize that, everything they're doing to try to be happy is exactly what would make them unhappy, karmically. You see what I mean? And it's like a big shock in your life. And when you get to that stage, the scriptures say, when you're able to think that other people are as unhappy as you are, meaning, you know, you're not going to commit suicide tomorrow, something like that. But I mean, you can't be satisfied with whatever you get, whether it's a person or a position or any other part of your life, your physical appearance, after a short time, you're unhappy again. It's your mind, you know. And when you realize that other people are all like that, deeply, when you're able to take that feeling of the first path and apply it to other people, you've reached bodhicitta. So according to all the scriptures, if you reach the first path and understand that it applies to everybody else, you have bodhicitta. They happen simultaneously. You're on the Mahayana five paths. If you don't feel it towards other people, you're on one of the two Hinayana five paths. Okay. In practice, when you reach Tonglam, the direct perception of emptiness, and right after that, you come down out of it, you have an intense experience of bodhicitta. And that's, you're on the first bhumi. So, you can be a, can you, we'll debate, okay, Mushi Musum. Do they teach you that in Italy? I don't know. Not yet. Okay. Mushi Musum is, let's discuss the, what do they call it? Permutations. It's a permutation debate. Okay. Mushi Musum. Papa Yena Chasin Bikebe, okay, which means, is everybody who's an Arya a Bodhisattva? Has everyone who's seen emptiness also become a Bodhisattva? I'll say, Papa Yena Chasin Bikebe, which means everyone who's seen emptiness directly must have already be a bodhisattva. Papa Yana tells me, and you say, Tamadu, which means, no way, you know. It's not true that everyone who's seen emptiness directly is a bodhisattva. Papa Yana tells me, Makapa. Are you telling me it's not true that everyone who's seen emptiness directly is a bodhisattva? We do a reconfirmation thing in debate. Are you telling me it's not true that everybody who's seen emptiness directly is a bodhisattva?
Yeah.
Duh means, that's what I said. Okay. Okay. And at this point, if you're the person sitting down, you are furiously thinking of an example that proves what you said. Okay? You're trying to stall every second you can get, you know, because you're stuck, you're in a corner. He's going to ask you in about a millisecond, show me someone who's seen emptiness directly, but who's not a bodhisattva. And they say, sure. And you say, chuchin. Taimen da chomba chuchin, which means consider an Hinayana arhat. Okay? Taimen da chomba chuchin. Papa Yimbata! You tell me he's an Arya?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I said. Okay. I need to tell you, Chansen Mayimbata. You tell me he's not a bodhisattva?
Duh.
And then I have to shut up. She smashed me. She defeated me. Okay. Alright? That's the first permutation. And that's the example. Okay? By the way, technically you have to say, someone who hasn't gone to a, well, that's a long story. Anyway. If you're discussing, well, we'll do the opposite permutation, but that there's movement between the five paths. You can be on a Mahayana five paths and descend to a Hinayana five paths, and you can be at a, yeah,
wow.
At certain stages, very delicate, okay? That's Genden Nishu, the study of the 20 permutations, but that's another story, okay?
You should teach us
now. No, 20, they're called the 20 Sangha 20. Yeah, anyway. Yeah, the guy who gave his eye to the guy and he smashed it. So he, you know, that's the ultimate bodhisattva vow breaking is to give it up, you know. Yeah, so it's possible, you know. So anyway, who can I pick on next? Now everybody goes like that. ready? Okay, ready? Wait. Chansey and a Papa Yimbi, Kevin. Everybody who's a bodhisattva must have seen emptiness directly.
Yes.
Oh. Then I have to come up with an example, okay? So I say, Te Chen So Lampa Chu Chen, okay? Which means, what about a person who's on the Mahayana path of renunciation? They've reached the first path already. Men Lam Lunda Masoa means, but they have not already traveled a Hinayana path. They went straight to the first path in the Mahayana, okay? Papa Yimbapa, you telling me they've seen emptiness directly? And then you say chi chi, which means, I didn't say that. Okay. Oh, then, Chansey and the Papa Yimbi Makapa. So you're telling me that if someone's a bodhisattva, they don't have to have seen emptiness directly? Duh. Then I say, tsa wa tsa, you know. Which means, you should be embarrassed, you know. You know, first you say one thing, and now you're saying the opposite thing. That's two of the moves, two of the permutations between. Two objects have four permutations, right? Chansen da Papa Nika Yimbi Mu Mebe Echa. There's nobody who's both a bodhisattva and who's seen emptiness directly. Damadu! Say Damadu! Yeah, Chansen Yayin, Papa Yayin Bishitu Yata. Show me someone who is both a bodhisattva. Oh, are you telling me there is somebody who's both a bodhisattva and has seen emptiness directly? The Shaw. Then you can say, Sangye Chomden De Che Che. Okay. What about Gautama, you know? Shakyamuni Buddha. He's seen emptiness directly. He's a bodhisattva, okay? Nikamayimayimu Shakyamebe Che. There's nobody who's neither. Tamadu, great. Nikamayimayimu Yaka. You tell me there is somebody who's neither? The Shaw. Tough. You can say Tuku Mayimbe Kiken Gao, okay? An old mangy dog who's not a tuku. Okay. Say Tapa Tasungi Rikpa. Say Tapa. Tasungi Rigpa means a special term in logic, meaning let's posit the theoretical example of an old mangy mutt who's not a tuku. Okay, meaning I don't personally know that any mangy mutt I meet is not a tuku. You see what I mean? Okay, all right. What time is it? Okay, we'll do another 15 minutes, okay? Perella, you already had a bunch, and you're in New York anyway. Yeah. And anyway, your questions are too hard.
Yeah. I've been trying to understand the difference between subtle and gross agitation and dullness. And as I understand subtle dullness and agitation, with subtle dullness, you keep losing the object. And also that's the case with subtle, I mean with gross agitation as well. With gross of both of those, you keep losing the object, right?
He asked me, what's the difference between... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Subtle agitation is where I have trouble understanding, because with subtle laxity, you're fixed on the object and you have a certain amount of clarity, but it's not intense.
Good, yeah.
In the case of subtle agitation, is it not also the case that you're fixed on the object, that you have some clarity? I mean, what is the real difference there? It must be a matter of the mind being in a more up and active state in the case of agitation, but I'm having trouble understanding, I guess, the real difference between subtle agitation and subtle laxity.
Yeah, so his question is, and yesterday we spoke about, or Tuesday we spoke about the difference between, you know, the two great extremes in meditation, getting too dull or spacing out, and then thinking about too many things, your mind going off on other subjects, agitation, what they call agitation. And then we said that specifically with dullness, there's a subtle dullness and an obvious dullness. Obvious dullness is when you're like nodding out, you know. You feel sleepy, and the typical causes are the room's too hot, you ate too much, or you didn't have enough sleep. And by the way, I emphasize the not enough sleep thing. I know a lot of Dharma practitioners in America who are trying to be like Lama Sopa and not sleep, you know. And it doesn't work for people at our level, okay? You must have enough sleep. It's impossible to meditate well if you're not sleeping well, okay? And conversely, if you're not sleeping well at all, it might be a sign that you're meditating the wrong way, okay? And if you have problems sleeping, it might be a sign of that, okay? And then we were concentrating a lot about subtle dullness. Subtle dullness being, you do have fixation on the object. You have not lost the object. You do have clarity, which doesn't refer to the clarity of the object, but refers to the clarity of your meditation, your state of mind. You are bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and engaged. Okay? It refers to the clarity of your own attention level. Okay? And then there's a thing called lar, which is like intense clarity, okay, and intensity of the clarity and the fixation, where we said you could compare it. It is exactly the feeling you have when you're reading a book that you really, really like. The attention level you have when you're watching the best part of an R-rated movie. You know, you're like, you know, like that. You know, and you're like, your mind is like, you know, you're not eating, nobody in the is eating popcorn at that time, you know. All these people are sitting there with their popcorn, you know. You look around the theater, you know, and everybody's like, you know, like that. And at that moment, that level of attention is nar. It's intensity. So it's, and then we kept talking about Jetsun Kapa emphasizing over and over and over again. First of all, nobody has any discipline. Nobody's meditating all the time. And then there's a few people who do meditate regularly, and most of them are stuck in subtle dullness, you know. They are focusing on the object correctly. They have not lost the object. They do have some clarity of mind. But there's no oomph, you know. There's no intensity. And that's subtle dullness. And he says you can live in that state of mind for decades and not make any progress in meditation. And I'm afraid that many Westerners get there, you know. Those few Westerners who are able to sit facing the wall without twitching a muscle for 3 hours, I'm afraid, I have a suspicion that many of them are in a state of subtle dullness, okay? Now, what he's asked me is a much harder question, which I would like to avoid, but I can't. What's the difference between obvious agitation and subtle agitation? Because we didn't talk about that. There is a distinction between obvious agitation and subtle agitation. It's not considered as dangerous as subtle dullness, because when you have subtle dullness, you think you're meditating well. Okay? And there's a very complicated explanation of it, and I'll tell you tomorrow, because I don't remember what it was. All right? And I don't want to get it wrong. So I'll check the scriptures, and I'll tell you tomorrow. Okay?
It could be a state of mind where there is fixation on the object, but there's kind of peripheral noise going on. It's other thoughts which seem to be in the background, which aren't overtaking the object of meditation, but there seems to be clarity of mind, and it's kind of like peripheral noise going on.
He says, could subtle agitation mean that you didn't lose the object, you're still fixed on the object, but there's this subtle noise going on, like background noise under your mind? And I do recall something in the scripture, and I want to look it up, and I'll tell you tomorrow, but they call it water running under the ice, is the word in the Lamrim. They say it's like water running under ice. And if you look at the top of the ice, it looks like the meditation's going pretty good. And I think you're exactly right. I think it's some kind of background noise going on where thoughts are running through your mind, but not strong enough to make you lose the object. But there's like subtle thoughts going through your mind, and you're still technically on the object, but there's this discussion going on in the back of your mind like water under the ice. And I think that is how they describe subtle agitation. But I'd rather tell you tomorrow, okay? Rather decide tomorrow. Yeah, Reed. Yeah, Rich said, and frankly, when I present the idea of karma as being totally your personal responsibility, you know, whenever something bad happens to you, there's only one person to blame, and that's yourself. So already you get in trouble in Western psychology, you know. Look, we have low enough self-esteem already. Most of the population thinks they're not worth anything. And then you come along and tell us every single problem we have, from traffic jams on Route 92 to, you know, the weather, is my fault, personally. You know what I mean? It's not helpful, you know. You're just getting people more depressed who are already depressed, you know. And in particularly, it seems very cruel and irresponsible to talk about, like, rape victims or people who've had been abused as children in different ways, to take them in a room and say, you know what, this is all your fault, you know, and you have created this. And then, and that this is considered by modern psychology like very, very negative and very much harmful to the people that you're telling that. Then there's a couple of things to say about it. First of all, it's very much an accepted part of Buddhism. And we're going to study it in New York in October. It's called Tange. Say Tange.
Tange.
Tange. Tange means the distinction between telling somebody what's true and telling them something that's good and helpful for them at that moment. Okay? And that's a big distinction in Buddhism. You know, 75% of what the Buddha taught in the four schools of ancient India is wrong. You know, his presentation of emptiness in the three lower schools of ancient India, okay, not the Tibetan schools, all right, is wrong. And Jetsun Kapa was mesmerized by this subject. He said, how do we know when the Buddha was speaking literally, and how do we know when he was just trying to sugarcoat it for his audience? And you see His Holiness doing the same thing when he speaks, you know. You can't speak in front of 5,000 people in Santa Monica Auditorium and tell them that they're all going to hell, you know. They just will leave and not come back. So he doesn't, and they are, okay. And he can't, you see what I mean? And so, yeah, I mean, as a Buddhist, and I know you're practicing that, you know, as a Buddhist who's you have people's lives are in your hand. You have to counsel them. You have to help them. You don't take them in the room and say, "You got raped yesterday. It's all your fault." You know what I mean? You don't say stuff like that. I mean, technically speaking, they did create that karma. Is it helpful or good to tell them that at that moment? Not at all. Okay. So first of all, you have to say that. Second of all, not only is this explanation not incorrect, not only does the child abuse thing disprove this explanation, it proves it. You see, I mean, I remember the first time I went to India, I went to Missouri, I froze on the cement floor of this church for 3 months studying sitar, okay? Not even Buddhism, okay? And I used to go to church. There was a church nearby. And there was an Indian pastor, you know, and I was a Christian. And I went in, I will never forget the first teaching he gave, because I was thinking, like, can an Indian give a good sermon, you know? And I went in, and he looks, like, out of place. You know, he's got all these robes on, and it's an Indian face, you know? And he goes into this long sermon called, Why do good people suffer? Actually, no, it was called, Why do the wicked prosper? He's saying, you know, you see people in business who are cutthroat, dishonest, cheating people, hurting people, and they're making lots of money. And so how can God be allowing this? You see, how can nasty people, by nasty actions, be getting a good result? You see, in the laws of karma, this is impossible. And in Christianity, it's a very big problem with that belief system. It's probably one of the greatest problems of that belief system. You know, why would God let this person get successful if they're hurting other people? You know, why would he allow that? It confuses people. It makes them lie and cheat and steal because it looks like it makes money. Why didn't he make the world run a different way? You know, and in Buddhism, the answer is quite clear. What? Lying, cheating, stealing, inevitably, invariably, always give you a bad result. Period. You always suffer when you do any of the above. But there's a time gap between doing it and getting the result. If you're getting rich at any given moment, there can only be one cause, and that's generosity to other people in the past, being a very generous person in the past. So I always say it's like this. We did this in Central Park. I don't know if you guys remember. This is generosity. You know, 10 years ago. This is lots of money coming to you now, later, okay? Then people in this life, in your world, in the United States of America in 1990, whatever it is, okay? Everybody in this country, and you included and me included, thinks that if you lie in a convincing way, it creates money. You believe that, you know. You believe it. In the depths of your heart, you believe it. You know, when somebody's accusing you of something and the time comes to lie, you lie because you think it will help. But really all the lie is causing is something here called, nobody believes me. Okay? The only result of lying is this very subtle thing where the people around you don't think you're smart, or don't think what you say is true, or don't think what you say means anything. They ignore you in meetings. They don't listen to you even when you're right. The only result of lying is that. The only cause of money is giving away money. Okay? And there's this illusion right here causes all the suffering of humanity. You see? The illusion that the lie has anything to do with getting money. My boss will tell me, go out and lie to that guy and we'll make more money on this parcel of diamonds, you know? That's a total illusion. It looks like this is causing this. They have no connection. No connection at all. It's very, very nasty. This is the cause of all suffering in the United States right now. That illusion. Okay. Where were we? What were you talking about? No, but what? Yeah, child abuse. Yeah. So, why do the wicked prosper? You know? And the same thing applies here, you know. It looks like this nasty guy is hurting this child, okay? You know, think of this as the nasty guy and this is the hurting the child, okay? Does he get pleasure from the child abuse? Does the abuser get some pleasure sometimes? Yeah, they're doing it because they have some pleasure out of it. Are they getting the pleasure from abusing the child? No. Okay? That pleasure is going to cause them intense suffering. Intense suffering. And this is very delicate, and you have to think carefully, okay? I'm not saying it's right to rape people. I'm trying to explain to you what's happening karmically. This guy is the raper. This is the woman being raped. Is he having pleasure at that moment? Yeah. It's a result of some good karma he did in the past. Can you handle that? Okay? It's a result of him honoring his sexual ethics. He was good in the past. He had an opportunity to commit adultery or something and he avoided it. He didn't do it. Therefore, he's having some pleasure now. You gotta follow that. The result of raping a woman is intense suffering in the hell realms. Okay? So, I mean, that action of raping the woman is going to cause him intense suffering later. And he's mistaking the rape for the cause of his pleasure. He doesn't understand where the pleasure is really coming from. If he'd wanted to have more pleasure, he should have been strictly ethical regarding women and men, you know, sexual ethics. He should have been strictly good. And he would have had all that he ever wanted. And what he's doing now is going to create intense suffering for him. Now, what about the victim? You know, the person getting raped. Are they a victim of this guy? No. Okay? They're a victim of some prior event where they harmed another person. Probably raped another person. Okay? Now, that's the reality of the karma that's going on. Now, a couple things to say. Do you take a woman who just got raped into a room and give her a lecture on why she did karma in her past life, you know? Absolutely not. It would be ridiculous. It would be the most stupid thing you can do. You know. Another question. Do you go out, grab the guy, and tell him, in the future, you're going to go to a hell rebirth. Bye. You know. God will punish you. You know, karma will punish you. We don't have to jail you, you know. Of course not. You see, it's your duty to go find the guy, lock him up, protect other people by doing so. It's your bodhisattva vow is to do that. You must go find the guy and prevent him from doing it more. You know, but karmically that's what's going on. Okay? And instead of being an inconsistency in Buddhism, it explains why good people suffer. I became a Buddhist because I couldn't find any reason why my dear mother, first mother, should be dying of cancer. You know? This fine person, this ethical person, this kind person is dying of cancer. What God would do that to such a nice person? You know what I mean? It just didn't make any sense to me. You know what I mean? So I'm saying it's not only not strange, it's comforting to know that. It's comforting to have the karmic explanation. You see what I mean? And that's the real... But does it mean you don't protect children? Of course not. You have to go out and catch these guys and control them, you know, and stop them from doing that. You're under bodhisattva vows to do that. So there's all this stuff going on. It explains why children suffer. It explains why a person in the womb can be ripped out and killed. They didn't do anything yet. Come on, they didn't have time to have a mental affliction yet. You know what I mean? And they're getting murdered, you know. So there has to be a reason for it. There has to be a cause for it. There has to be an explanation for it. To me, it comforts me to know that. You know what I mean? It would drive me mad, and almost did, to think that good people will be slaughtered by some compassionate God. You know what I mean? It doesn't make any sense. It's crazy. It's crazy to think that. And that viewpoint harms many people every day. You know, to continue to believe in that, when it's so obviously harmful to people's happiness, is a serious problem. You know, and it's not like we should go out and burn down all the Christian churches, okay? I'm not saying that. I'm saying that viewpoint doesn't work. And out of compassion, gently, under the right circumstances, without being missionaries, you have to try to show people the other viewpoint, which is where suffering is really coming from. Because the viewpoint that is just the whim of some divine being is hurts people. It makes them keep hurting themselves. You know what I mean? It's a disservice to people. It's not. It's obviously not true or logical. But you have to do it very gently, okay? And only when people want it and are asking you for it. In Buddhism, we're not allowed to go out and harass people with your religion, okay? The reason you offer the mandala before class is that, technically speaking, I cannot teach you a class unless you request it. You know, you cannot normally teach Buddhism to a person unless they have shown great interest and they've asked you to teach it. If you know they might be very, very interested and they just didn't know enough to ask you, you can bring it up softly. But you can't go out with Trichan Rinpoche's meditation chart and knock on doors and, you know, and say, good morning, you know. Okay, you can't do that. Not supposed to do that. Yeah, well, I think one more there, yeah.
If you push that a step further, yeah. A rapist can't rape anybody who has created the climate to be raped.
He said if you take that logic one step further, then it would be impossible for a rapist to rape anyone who had not already collected the karma to be raped, and that's absolutely true.
Then why lock him up?
Why lock him up means, actually, you can't prevent him from raping another person if there's another person around who has the karma to be raped by that person, and he might rape someone in prison, for example. You see what I mean? That's true. As a bodhisattva, you have to lock him up out of compassion. Like, does it stop him from raping another person if another person has the karma to be raped? No, it doesn't, you know. On a relative level, you have to attempt. I'll give you an example. Someone's getting mugged in New York City. You're watching them being beaten up by somebody. You see this from time to time in New York. If you go to their rescue and you're successful and you pull the guy off of them, who did that heroic action? Why did the guy stop beating them up? It was their karma that you could intervene and be helped. You see what I mean? They collected the karma to have you up. You are the instrument of their karma. You know, you can be happy that you did it and all that, but if you try to intervene and you're successful in intervening and you pull them off of them, it's their good karma that you appeared, and their good karma has created your action at that moment. If you intervene and the guy turns around and stabs you, and they keep beating them up afterwards, they didn't have enough good karma for you to intervene. The only real action you're undertaking is the karma of attempting to intervene. You are collecting intense good karma by attempting to intervene. Whether the intervention is successful or not depends only on their karma. It's very interesting. You're right. What you say is right. It is true that that if you lock them up, they may or may not continue to rape. You see what I mean? And that's the way it works. Okay, but you still have to try. And the main result of trying, the main result of locking them up, is that you collect the virtue of attempting to protect people. Okay. Another point on that, and I'll ask you a question. Does a Buddha perfect the six perfections? Huh? No, I mean, when you get to enlightenment, can we say that you are perfect in that you have perfected the six perfections? Like giving. Has a Buddha reached the final evolution of the perfection of giving? You know, is a Buddha giving things perfectly? Yeah. Are there still poor people in the world? Yeah. You see what I mean? The perfection of giving is not defined by the absence of poor people in the world. And the perfection of protecting other people is not defined by the success of the attempt at protection. It's defined by the desire to do so perfectly. And you might get your rear end beat up, and they might continue beating up the other person, but you have perfected the action of giving protection to another person. You see? So perfecting the perfections depends on your attitude and not on the success of your actions. And that's important for people who are trying to be Buddhist. You know, because you can think, you know, you go through the world trying to do your 10 perfections. You go through the world trying to do your bodhisattva activities, and it backfires. You know, like you're trying to help somebody and they start hating you. You try to teach a class and then five of the students in the class turn out to, you know, hate your guts, you know. Have you failed in your teaching? No. You see, if you teach with the proper motivation and you teach good dharma, you have perfected the act of teaching. That's important for people who are trying to be bodhisattvas in a practical sense. Don't judge the success of your bodhisattva behavior by the results of what you do, because that's a result of your old karma. Okay? It's not true that the best teacher in the world might not have students who act very bad. Okay? You see what I mean? Because that's a result of your old karma. And the Buddha, in his lifetime, was the object of three or four murder attempts by his students and by his sponsors. Okay? Does that mean he wasn't a good teacher, or he didn't succeed, or he wasn't doing his bodhisattva activities well? No. He still had some old bad karma left over. You see what I mean? So in a practical sense, if you're trying to be a bodhisattva and you go out and do this kind thing to somebody and you work really hard at it and it fails, don't think it has anything to do with your bodhisattva activity. You're doing fine. And the karma of it will be very, very sweet. And don't think that this is causing this. You see what I mean? To get depressed, you're trying to be a good bodhisattva. You act good towards other people, and they come back to you bad. It's one of these tricks here. It's one of these illusions. This is a big illusion right here. So don't get discouraged. You know, you're trying to be a good Buddhist, and then everybody in your Dharma center thinks you're bad. You know, if you've done it with sincerity, then you're okay, and it will be a good karma. But don't always expect that everything will come out rosy, because it doesn't. And that's because of your old bad karma. Okay. All right, we'll stop there. And see you, what time tomorrow? 9:30, which is 10, I think. Okay. All right. Okay. Pagi to shame at our time. Rabbing shame in the gambadi. Sange shindu mite huagi. Tokunam dakshina chapa sho. Ranamadala kamiyatayami. Dike woku. Sanami she tozo shi Sanami she ne chue Tamba guni toba shou